Our next presentation is, I hope, going to be one of the highlights. It is one of the highlights of the festival. We have with us today that rare thing, a writer Graham Greene admired. That Graham Greene was incapable of praising books he didn't like, and he truly admired those of our next presenter. Michael Muschaw is a retired professor of the University of Texas at Austin, where he was the head of the creative writing program. He's lived for many years in Europe. He's written 11 novels and has one coming out after a long gap, 15 years. So the novel's novelist is about to do his magic again, plus a dozen books of nonfiction. You may have encountered his very elegant writing on tennis. We're thrilled today to have Michael reading to us from his memoir, My Man in Antibes, that's about his friendship with Graham Greene and his own life interweaved. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and speak to us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure to be here, and enlightening, too, to hear the talks about Greene. And every time I go to another session, my own remarks change, and I keep thinking my emphasis will change. And I will read you a short section from this book, but I wanted to start with a couple of remarks or observations. I mean, I think that there have been various emphases here by the speakers, but I don't think it should be neglected to mention Graham Greene's emotional problems, and that you should keep in mind that he was what we would now call bipolar, and that he was, from a very early age, troubled by episodes of mania and then depression. And I remember toward the end of his life, I asked him how he was doing in that area, and he said, well, he used to have greater mood swings, but as he aged, he held up his hands, and he had Dupuytren's contracture, so on the one hand, that his fingers were very gnarled, and he said, now I find things are much more even, but it didn't look like he was drawing an even line, given that he had Dupuytren's contracture. But, you know, there was a biography recently of Robert Lowell by Kay Jameson, who is herself an analyst and who herself was bipolar, and she interpreted Lowell's life and his poems in terms of his bipolar condition, and the emphasis was on his behavior and trying to understand his behavior, try to explain his behavior. I don't think there, in my own opinion, I don't think there's sufficient emphasis in the case of Greene. It's difficult to say, I was gonna say considerable amount of time around him. I spent enough time around him that I witnessed depressive episodes. I didn't see much mania, but I saw certainly depressive episodes. I think that's one thing that I would like to emphasize, but I think also it can't be emphasized enough that he was a Catholic, but more importantly, that he was a Catholic convert. And isn't someone going to speak tomorrow about his relationship with that other Catholic, right? you're speaking about, who's speaking? Okay, and who is that Catholic, right? Anthony Burgess, and Burgess made a delineation between a cradle Catholic, which he was, and a converted Catholic. But I mean, since so many of you are English, you could tell me what it means to have converted to Catholicism, especially in the 20s or 30s. I mean, it seemed like a very bizarre choice, like maybe an Afrikaner in South Africa to becoming an honorary black or something. I mean, it was frowned on, but it was a serious part of his life, although it wasn't one that you could interpret consistently. I'm an American, I'm of Irish extraction, so my Irish-American Catholicism was considerably different from Green's notions of Catholicism. And I read recently in the Tablet a review of the book where it said they wish I'd spoken more about Green and I talking about religion. That's the last thing he ever wanted to talk about. And it had been dinned into me from the first time I met him, and also by the priest who arranged for us to meet, that if you start talking about religion, that's going to be the end of the conversation and perhaps the end of your relationship, or you're not going to have a relationship with him. He did allude to his Catholicism. He knew I was Catholic. I mean, he knew that from my books, but it occurred to me that just today that I wrote a book from the point of view. In fact, it was narrated by a Catholic priest, and he was very fond of that book. It was about a priest who had had a nervous breakdown and gone to Italy to recover and then came back and was assigned to Austin, Texas, where I never retired. I taught for 5 years there. I pride myself on having taught in toto only 8 years in my so-called career, and I got out of academia as soon as I could afford to, and at the age of 37, gave up tenure at the University of Texas and moved to Italy. Now, I have two sons. If either of them did something that stupid and rash, I would beat them with a bicycle chain. I mean, I can't believe that I did it, but I thought that Italy was much cheaper in those days. In fact, it was a bargain, and it was easy to make a living there. You didn't have to make much of a living. The other thing that I wanted to mention, and this is really opening a terrible can of worms, and that is we were referring in the Nobel Prize, the imbroglio of Green's never winning it, and the possibility that his affair with Anita Bork had queered the deal. And it raises in my mind something that hasn't been much talked about here, and I'm not going to say a lot about it, but somebody might want to say something about it, is in this era of the Me Too movement, in this era where things have changed so much that the biography by Blake Bailey of Philip Roth was, you know, sequestered, repressed, done away with because there were accusations that Blake Bailey himself was guilty of some Me Too offenses. And anyway, why was he writing a biography of Philip Roth, who was a terrible offender in this way? If Green were on this earth now and still writing, he would run the risk that any number of writers have run and been knocked down for. I mean, I have friends, associates, colleagues who are now completely pariahs because of their real or imagined sexual offenses, many of them far, far more innocent than Green. I mean, the objection in Sweden to his affair with Anita Bork was also predicated on the fact that this relationship, which I take it she took seriously, was taken a lot less seriously by Green. But then that could be said of all of his relationships going back to his marriage. There was never a time when he wasn't cheating on whoever he was with. I mean, Catherine Walston may have been the love of his life, but that didn't prevent him from having other relationships. He was still having a relationship with her when he got involved with Anita Bork. And people in Sweden knew this. As I said, somebody at some point is going to write a dissertation or maybe a book about Me Too and Graham Greene. For someone who supposedly was very private about his life and reluctant to deal with journalists or to indulge in personal disclosures, I'll have to say that from the first time I met him, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, a young guy who just published a couple of books. He didn't know me from Adam, but he had my wife and me over for drinks. And within half an hour, he was holding forth about his mistress at the time, Yvonne Cloetta, describing their relationship, including their sexual relationship. I mean, it was like being on a Trailways bus with somebody from an oversharer from Southern California or something. It was most shocking. I mean, shocking in the sense that not what I expected. And he also made a point of speaking disparagingly of Yvonne Cloetta's husband, Jacques Cloetta, who she was still married to. He lived in Africa for 11 months a year and then came up to France to spend a month with her and his daughters. And Graham, at that point, would shove off and go and travel with Father Duran in Spain. As I said, this wasn't the sort of thing that I thought we would get to speaking about at our first meeting. So I think that whether it was because what? We were young and from America? I don't know, or I have no idea whether he made a practice of doing this kind of thing. But he did speak, as I say, very disparagingly of Jacques Cloetta, saying that, after all, he's Swiss, and you know what the Swiss are like. He said the guy is either an idiot and doesn't realize his wife is having an affair, or he realizes it and is too Swiss to do anything about it. So that didn't seem like something that I would have expected of Graham Greene. And there was another thing that I didn't expect of Graham Greene, and that is that in his apartment, which Jay Perini referred to yesterday as being a grand apartment in Antibes, it was not a grand apartment. It was a very small apartment. It was two rooms. It was more like a bed sit than a grand apartment. But he had various works of art on the wall, and he had a couple of maquettes sitting on his coffee table, and one of them was obviously a Henry Moore. I recognize Henry Moore anytime you see a statue that looks like it has bullet holes in it or something, openings. And he said, yeah, Henry Moore gave it to him, and he said, it's now worth $50,000. And then there was another one there, a cylindrical, silver-plated deal that looked like something like Jean Arp or Brancusi. And Linda picked it up and said, who did this? And he said, I'm not really sure. And she said, well, it must have come with papers. I mean, and he said, well, I bought it from a chemist in Nice. And she said, well, didn't he know where it came from? And he said, well, the only instructions that came with it were, use it once a day to apply your hemorrhoid medicine. Now, he was a fiendish teller of practical jokes or pulling practical jokes. Was this a joke? I mean, and wasn't it an appropriate joke to tell my 26-year-old wife who was holding this thing and she gently put it back on the table? I'm just trying to give you a sense that Graham Greene was, yes, he was frequently depressed, but he was also frequently a very spirited joke teller and also joke puller, I should say, somebody who had a prankster. And so I all of this has to be taken into consideration. I think it's difficult to hold more than one or two ideas about somebody in mind at the same time, but I think it's what one has to do where Greene is concerned. Now, I promised Richard that I would tell about my own Nobel Prize experience. I was in Morocco. I was giving a talk down there, and via the, what was it called, the USAID, or it used to have a different name. They changed it constantly because it was confused with the CIA, but I invited to be there to talk about, all about myself. It was... and I talk about my books. And I, you know, these things that are, don't the English have something like this too, or where they send speakers out to talk? At any rate, U.S. Information Agency. And usually these things are attended by seven people, local academics or something. But I spoke, and then afterward a gentleman came, it was a Moroccan. He was good enough to speak to me in English, not in French or Arabic. He said, but he was a local television announcer, and he, would I appear on his television show? And I said, well, about what? He said, just talk about yourself and come on. So I came on the show. I figured this guy's, his audience is probably as large as mine, six or seven people. But he asked me a number of questions, each of them more idiotic than the previous one. And then he said, and when can we expect you to win the Nobel Prize? And I said, I think there's one thing that we can be sure of, or two things, death, and that I'll never win the Nobel Prize. And he said, no, I'm sure that in the coming years, you will be a Nobel Prize winner. Thank you very much. And I came up and thought, Jesus, this is incredible. Well, the next talk I gave was in an amphitheater like this, only maybe three times as large, and it was full. I mean, there's more people, not only than I had ever spoken to, but that I had ever sold copies of books to. And thereafter, in both Casablanca and later on in Marrakesh, I would go into a restaurant and people would recognize me. So, as a Nobel Prize loser, just like Graham Greene, I know what it's like to be uncomfortably lionized. And so, at any rate, I'm going to read you a short passage from the book, and then I hope I can entertain questions and afterward. I mean, I may not answer them, but I'll entertain them. And when we lived in the south of France, Linda and I were recently married. I had had a Fulbright, and we had rented this teeny cottage, which had the unfortunate unfortunately had no heating system. So we nearly froze to death our first summer, winter there. And nearby, in a sort of a grand house, a grand Provençal house, there lived an American who was actually an Irish American who had mercy on us and loaned us a poêle à mazout, a oil heater to heat the place, and took mercy on us and took an interest in us. And he asked me if I played tennis, and I said I didn't. I was interested in sports, but I never played. And he said, I'll teach you. And so what he was looking for is a partner. And so he began teaching me to play tennis. I was then 29. And he said, after we had played a few times, you could play this sport. He said, if you'll learn how to play the sport and get good enough to play with me, he was then 50, he said, I'll let you have this house every summer while I go to Ireland, where I also have a house. I mean, the house was had a swimming pool, had a tennis court, had 7 acres around it. It was quite grand. And this seemed like a fantasy to me. I mean, a worrying fantasy. I wondered what was in it for him. But that's all he wanted. He wanted me to play tennis, get good enough to play him. And then when I got good enough to beat him very shortly, he started fixing me up with other people in the neighborhood to play tennis. And he, good as his word, every summer he would leave the house and go to Ireland, and we would live like hermit crabs in a great elaborate shell. Linda and I would be scuttling around in this great place. But we invited Green to come to lunch one day, and usually that meant going to pick him up in Antibes, because he didn't drive. I mean, if you can imagine that this driver, this intrepid traveler throughout the world, didn't drive. And as Paul Theroux remarked once in the New York Times, I mean, he didn't drive, he didn't type, he didn't cook, he didn't take care of his house. He really always needed a lover. He always needed a mistress. But we invited him to come to this house called Montclair. We didn't tell him, as my mother, Don't tell her I'm married. if I can find this, I marked it and then I pulled my marker out. Excuse me, this is terrible to do this to you. As I said, I marked it, put this in there, and then promptly took it out. I see another. I'll read you about another time when another time when Graham came to visit us when we were living much more humbly in a little cottage. And this is why he was so surprised when later on he came and saw us in a mansion and said, "Do you own this?" And the evening of our dinner with Green, I fetched him from Antibes, and because the round trip took an hour, I dreaded how many, during this time, we were being infested by mice, how many guillotined mice might pile up in my absence. Naturally, I was nervous. Who wouldn't be with Graham Green coming to dinner in the kitchen crawling with mice? I tried to make small talk on the way back, mentioning that we were having difficulty deciding where to spend the autumn. "Why not Brighton?" Green suggested. In Ways of Escape, he had written that no city, not London, Paris, or Oxford, has such a hold on my affections. But his depiction in Brighton Rock suggested anything except affection. With its shingle beach, as penitential as a bed of nails, its British sunbathers laid out like bodies in a morgue, it was the perfect setting for a murder mystery in the form of a morality play. "We're looking for some place warm," I said, "some place where we can play tennis." "Brighton's often quite mild in autumn," Green said, "and it has tennis courts. Of course, there's the rain." I said, "We're considering Spain, the Costa del Sol." "That'll be expensive," Green said. "In England, tennis is a middle-class sport. In Spain, it's a rich man's game. Don't you find it distasteful that you'll be lining General Franco's fascist pockets with cash?" I considered, but quickly dismissed the temptation to tease him that his upcoming excursion to Spain would also support the dictator. I told him we had found a flat in Marbella at a bargain price. In fact, it was $125 a month, which should give you an idea of how long ago this was. "If it's cheap, it's bound to be appalling," Green said. Linda welcomed us back to the house, her eyes moist with tears. Maybe Miss Green mistook this for delight at seeing him. She whispered to me that I'd better check under the sink. The smallest mouse yet, hairless and pink, lay broken in a trap like the barbecued shrimp on a grill. Resetting the trap, I joined Linda and Green. Dry-eyed now, she had poured him a whiskey and listened to him praise Brighton. I kept an ear cocked for the clack of another execution of a mouse. By the time we sat down for the first course, a tomato salad with diced onions and vinaigrette, no trap had sprung, but I remained rigid with anticipation. Green, too, appeared tense. Painstakingly, he separated the tomatoes from the onions. He nibbled bread that he dunked in the vinaigrette, avoiding the tomatoes altogether. Linda looked distraught. This probably struck Green as a regret at her failed first course. I knew better, and hearing a clack, I hurried into the kitchen to tend the traps. The second course was roast beef and pomme de terre. "I apologize for the meat," Linda said. "I'm afraid I've overcooked it." "One gets sick of raw beef in New France," Green reassured her. "This is delicious." Between bites, we discussed American authors. Green observed that they reminded him of what Churchill had said about Russia. "They're a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I find them all very strange. Why do they all feel compelled to marry every woman they sleep with?" "I've been married to the same woman since 1927, he said. "Think of Norman Mailer and Saul Bellow and all their wives. Think of the alimony that they must pay. A staggering amount. He sliced his beef into bite-sized slivers that he pushed with his knife onto the back of his fork. Some writers seem to have the mark of Cain on them, he said. Malraux has that facial tick, and Sartre has a wall eye, and Moravia limps, and Steinbeck's got a terrible complexion. Maybe Marilyn Mailer's course is that he can't stop marrying. Like clockwork, a mousetrap sounded. Time for dessert, I said. After I discarded the fresh carcass, I brought mousse au chocolat to the table. Green pronounced it marvelous and ate a second helping topped with whipped cream. On the road back to Antibes, I drove slowly and cautiously. I had had too much to drink. Green had also had a healthy share of alcohol and spoke with a slight lisp, as he often did when he overindulged. I apologize for upsetting Linda, he said, by not eating the tomatoes. She probably assumes you have an allergy, I said. It's a bit more embarrassing than that. He explained that as a young man, he feared he had contracted what he called a social disease. I consulted a doctor and he told me never to eat tomatoes. I've obeyed his instructions ever since. I laughed, thinking this was one of his tipsy attempts at humor, but he insisted he was serious and cited his recent introduction to the reprint of Brighton Rock that referred to the social disease and the doctor's advice. I didn't have it in me to correct Green and tell him that Linda was crying over dead mice, not uneaten tomatoes. The great man's idiosyncrasies and odd beliefs didn't reduce him in my estimation. They humanized him, made him more accessible, raised my respect for what he had accomplished. No less than Malraux with his nervous tic and Sartre with his wall-eyed, he was an author who triumphed over innate awkwardness to create great art. Now that's what I'll read you. I wish I could find that place where he came to our grand house, and he made a point of saying to me, I asked him, would you like to take a swim before lunch? And he said, no, I never take my clothes off in mixed company, something to that effect. I said, why not? And he said, I have four nipples. I said, what? He said, I have four nipples. I have no idea if this is true, and I know in your collection of letters, he mentions this affliction. I have no idea what the leather was honest either, but he was someone who liked to tell bizarre tales, some of which were true, many of them weren't true, but I was going to say that when he visited us at this grand house, and I made it clear it wasn't our house, that we were guests there, he made it a point of saying, I never let anyone stay in any of my houses. I said, okay. He said, because I find that a house where many people have visited becomes no one's house. It's just a public space. And I was offended by this. I would never have thought of asking him to let me live in his place in Capri. And he later on, though, much later, when he was quite old, he offered to sell the place to me, and which was sort of ridiculous given our poverty at the time. But he offered to sell it to us for $250,000, which was much less than it was worth. He himself had, it was a gift to him. Alex Korda bought it for him while they were doing the Third Man script. And Alex Korda paid the grand sum of $4,000 for it in 1933 or whatever. So I suspected at first that Green was, that his ownership of this villa was never quite legal in the Italian sense. It's a frequent story. There's people buy property and then find out that the person who sold it to him didn't really have the right to sell the property to him. And that Green was going to sell it to me, having no clear title to it, and that since I lived in Italy, he felt I could deal with that. But then it occurred to me, maybe he was making up and passing along this favor to me that was a favor to him when Alex Korda gave it. He could be a very generous person, but he could be a very persnickety person too. And much of my book, maybe a third of it, deals with a terrible tiff we had in, I guess it was the early 80s, really, no, in the 70s, 77. Because after I'd known him for a couple of years, Jay Perini mentioned yesterday that he had thought of proposing to do a story on Green for the New Yorker, or he considered that. And I actually had an assignment from Playboy to do a story on Green after I'd known him for 3 or 4 years. They didn't want me to go back and revisit him to make sure that I was accurate, but they wanted me to write it from memory, from my experiences with him. I told Green what I was going to do, and I asked his permission, and he said, yes, as long as you don't say anything about Yvonne in the piece, have on, go ahead and write it. And I wrote it, and Playboy turned it down and said that wasn't what they were looking for, and they said, doesn't he have a mistress? I said, well, I wasn't going to write that. And they said it sounded too much like one writer talking about another writer. And so I felt, well, I'll have no trouble publishing this. And I sent it to my agent at the William Morris Agency at that time. And he tried every place to get it published. And he sent it to the New Yorker, first of all, and they dismissed it. And we sent it, finally, it took 2 years. I mean, I was shamefaced with Green because I kept saying, wait. And he didn't care one way or the other. And I offered to show him the article, and he was uninterested in that too. Finally, in desperation, I sold it to the London magazine in London for £50, or £30, and to the Nation magazine in the United States for $50. So that was my reward for doing this. When the thing came out, Green excoriated me. He wrote the longest letter I've ever received from him, saying that everything in it was wrong, that everything in it was my novelist imagination. And I felt I had a choice then of just digging a hole for myself and disappearing, or I could take him up on this and say, you seem to forget that when we spoke, there were two novelists in the room, and if I could have imagined these incidents that I report, I would have used them in my own fiction, which is what I suggest you should have done. That elicited from him another very, very harsh letter. I sent him back an equally harsh letter. You have to remember I was 32 or 33 at the time, and he was Graham Greene. But at any rate, after this exchange of letters, I thought, well, I'll never see him or hear from him again. But he just finally said, let's forget all about it. Merry Christmas. And that was it. And we went on with our relationship. And several possibilities present themselves to me. One, it was observed by a number of friends of his that he felt that nothing was a better cure for depression than a good fight. And so maybe this provided him with a good fight. The other possibility is that in the course of talking to me and drinking, that he rounded off a number of stories that he had told various versions of in the course of his life. And I talk in my book about various times when he told contrasting versions of the same story. He, like many novelists, could embroider, if not, what is beyond embroider, brocade the truth and tell it in a different fashion. Ultimately, he had many opportunities to correct what I had written, because a number of magazines asked to reprint that article, and before I gave any agreement to that, I gave Green the opportunity to say what was wrong with it or have me correct it. And in each case, he said, go ahead and let him publish it, go ahead and let him publish it. And in my collected essays that came out in 1986 or something, I offered him the chance once again to correct it. And he said, no, just let it go ahead. And I thought, well, either the mistakes I made were not so extreme as what he made it sound they were, or he felt, this is just another occasion where I can muddy the water about my past and about and make it difficult for my biographers, as I don't know whether Richard's experience was made difficult by the fact that he kept various journals, some of them secret, some of them public, some of them had contradictory stories. But anyhow, to show that no good deed goes long unpunished, having started off, as Jay mentioned, trying to get the story published in The New Yorker, a year after it came out in the United States, it came out in The New Yorker, but under a different writer's name. It came out under Penelope Gilliatt's name, and she had plagiarized my article extensively. And by then I must have been 34 years old, and totally obscure, but I wrote The New Yorker and told them William Sean, and said what had happened. And usually when I wrote an editor in those days, it would take 3 weeks for him to get back to me. He called back right away and said that Penelope Gilliatt had a drinking problem and they were most regretful and he was afraid that she'd commit suicide and blah, blah, blah. And he said, what do you want from me? And I said, I'd like an apology in the magazine and I'd like to be paid for my work. And he said, whoa. He said, how much do you want? And I said, I want whatever she got. And he went, It's hard to say, you know, we have a sliding scale, depends on the writer's seniority at The New Yorker, our contract, what I think of them on any given day. And he said, I'll give you $1,000, which didn't seem like much to me. And he said, and as for acknowledgement in the magazine, I couldn't possibly do that because I think she'd commit suicide. And so he said, it's a moral choice on your part. I said, suddenly it's a moral choice on my part? But I said, well, I don't want anybody to commit suicide. And he said, tell you what, if you don't make me publish an acknowledgement, I'll give you $2,000. And my salary at the University of Texas then was $12,000 a year. So $2,000 sounded like big money, especially since he said this was all, you know, we had no idea this was happening. I don't know how this slipped by the fact checkers and so forth. Subsequently, it came out very quickly that the fact checking department had noticed this plagiarism, had brought it to his attention, had warned him that it was plagiarized. He had then confronted Penelope Gilliatt, who denied it and said she'd commit suicide. And that's how it happened. I mean, he lied. Talk about the moral choice. He lied to me. And this has been written about repeatedly by Renata Adler and by other editors at The New Yorker who published their memoirs. As I was writing this book, I had signed an agreement with The New Yorker, by the way, that they'd give me the $2,000 and that they would never reprint Penelope Gilliatt's story, that it would never come out in any collection of The New Yorker's work or anything like that. They agreed to this in writing. I went back as I started doing this book to do some research, and I went online and noticed that The New Yorker online has all the articles that have ever appeared in The New Yorker. And I thought, surely they won't have this one, but they do. And it is verbatim. All the stuff that she took from me is repeated there, and it has no indication that about anything. So I contacted The New Yorker again, and having had this early experience with them much, much later, it was the same thing. David Remnick said to me, but sue us. And I did hire a lawyer and did finally force them with the legal threat to give me a bit of money to pay my lawyer, but also to put in something in their online, record, that portions of this article have appeared previously in The Nation under Michael Mushaw's name, and they've been repeated here without attribution. That was the most that he would do. So this was the article that I did on Green that will never die, that was like a zombie that kept popping up and you'd have to put a stake in its heart. And I'll stop now and start entertaining questions if there are any questions.
Hi. First of all, It's a pleasure to see you, Michael, and your lovely wife, Linda. Nice to have met you. I finished your memoir yesterday. Fantastic.
Thank you.
What I wanted to ask you was, in the end of the memoir, there is a piece that you write about your experience with Anthony Burgess.
Yeah. Well,
his wife and his children.
Yeah.
When Green died, the night he died, the BBC ran a piece where they interviewed Burgess, who, in my opinion, crucified Green in a really very unpleasant manner.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to just ask you what your opinion is of the relationship between Anthony Burgess and Graham Greene, and why, at the end, it was so antagonistic and so unpleasant.
I don't know. I mean, I and you'll know more tomorrow, I'm sure, about it, but I only could quote in my book what Greene said to me, and also what they had written when both men were still alive, you know, when they were having this discussion. In a sense, history may have been repeating itself. Greene took great umbrage to an article that Burgess wrote about him. Burgess claimed that he had showed Greene the article and Greene had signed off on it. Then after it appeared, he said that Burgess had wildly misquoted him and put words into his mouth and so forth. What the genesis of it was, whether it was because some personal animosity, or as Greene suggested, it was the contrast between a cradle Catholic and a Catholic convert. And Burgess himself said that Greene didn't identify with the sort of cradle Catholics who were Irish and Italian and that sort of thing. I, perhaps tomorrow you can answer these questions. You know, as for, I knew Burgess very, very little. I only met him once or twice. And he always said to me, every time he met me, more than once or twice, but he always started off the conversation by saying, "Do I owe you something?" And I said, I think he was used to people saying, "Look, don't you remember you owe me $100 or you owe me a free dinner?" But he started every conversation with, "Don't I owe you something?" A blurb of this or that, the other thing. And I published an earlier memoir about my relationship with all these writers, which is entitled, "Do I Owe You Something?" In the book, you'll see that he famously stuck me with a bar bill at the Carlton Hotel in Cannes during the film festival, having started off by saying, "Do I owe you something?" and then left me with a stiff drink bill. But Burgess was always very amusing in person. I found his books amusing. I liked many of them. I told Greene this story, but it was more to amuse Greene. My role sometimes with Greene was court jester. My mother was manic depressive, and I frequently had to cheer her up and tell funny stories and try to make her laugh. And I would say that my greatest contribution to Graham Greene is that I could make him laugh and told him many, many stories that he remembered and wrote about later on. And he would always compare them to a story that I told him about being robbed in Key West, Florida by a man who was wielding a banana, the banana burglar. So he would always say, "This is not quite as good as the banana burglar story," or this is even better than the banana, or "Your best since the banana burglar." And that's how Richard and I met. There was a reference in one of Greene's letters to somebody else about a friend of mine in Florida has just been held up by a man with a banana, and Richard said, "Is this you?" I said, "That's me." I really can't answer your question about Burgess, but I know there was this friction between them, and you're going to learn much more about Burgess tomorrow. Anyone else? Oh, this embarrasses me that no one has a single, just one question.
Not so much a question, really, just a thank you. That was fascinating.
Thank you.
I hope your book's available outside. I'm, you know, absolutely this minute going to go and buy it. And
tell a friend.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love your story, really, about, not being a Nobel Prize loser, because I was once, and this is name dropping, I was standing beside Seamus Heaney in the Sherborne Hotel, Dublin, where he was going to give a lecture. And at the time, I was a writer for children. I wrote children's books published by the O'Brien Press in Dublin. And somebody came in and saw two writers, saw us both, and she said, "Oh, two writers together." Now, this was, I think, the year before Seamus Heaney won the Nobel.
did you know Heaney?
Yes,
okay.
Yes,
well,
he
thank
was.
Thank God you knew him.
Well, yeah. Well, I just said to him, Des O'Connor and Pavarotti are both singers, but Pavarotti wouldn't like the comparison. And so Seamus said to me, "Oh, don't put yourself down, Crina," to which I replied, "What makes you think I meant you were Pavarotti?"
Ah, that's great. That's great. I was always mistaken quite often in London for W.G. Sebald, whose first name was Max. And people would say to me, "Max, how are you?" I say, "Sorry, I'm not Max Sebald." Then he threw himself in front of a car or something like this. And then I began saying, "I was Max Sebald." And then come back to life. Yes, Dave.
Mine is a bit of a sporting question, actually. When you were talking about playing tennis or learning to play tennis, how long did it take you to beat the person who was teaching you so you could take over his house when he went to Ireland?
It didn't take me long. I mean, he was 50 years old. I was 28 or 29 by then. And I took to the game very quickly. I mean, I didn't ever have a conventional or classic game, but I became a good sort of club level player. And learning tennis from him, as much as anything, changed my life, because I went on to not only play it up until I was 80, my wife Linda and I would play all the time, but also I wrote 4 books about professional tennis, and so.
But that was the only house you were allowed to live in. You didn't have to beat other players to live in people's houses.
Yeah, you have to be good. He had sons too, and he matched me against them. And it reminds me, because I start off my books by saying that most kids, when they're young, grade schoolers, are taught by their parents to sing their ABCs. And my stepfather taught me to box from the time I was 6 years old. And he would match me against my older brother, who quickly learned to hate me because I always beat him. And but then my father overmatched me with an older boy who broke my nose. And this was an instructive thing, that you can't always depend on your father to teach you something. Better that he had taught me my ABCs. Did you have a question, Lucas?
Yes, I did. Thank you very much, Michael, for just the anecdotes. Those were phenomenal. And speaking of anecdote, I only heard probably half the story last night at dinner, but I wanted to get the rest of the story about your time in Haiti in Green's Comedian's Hotel. I just didn't know if you wanted to sort of expand on what happened.
We were just mentioning that Linda and I, this all seems very bizarre at this point. Green mentioned once that when he reread something that he had written 4 years before, he said the writer of 40 years ago is not the writer of today. And so sometimes you feel that you're talking about or reading a stranger. And some of these anecdotes are so long in the tooth now, I wonder who it was who did these things. But Lynn and I courted her by taking her to Mexico and having her read The Power and the Glory. And then when we got married, we We went to Haiti for our honeymoon, where Papa Doc was still in power, and we stayed at the Olufsen in the Graham Greene suite. And I think I mentioned last night, it ended the last day we were in Haiti or in Port-au-Prince. The hotel closed down, they pulled down shutters, made sure everybody went to their room because there was a coup, and it turned out that Papa Doc and his wife had had a fight, had an argument, and she chased him into the bathroom, and he locked himself in there. But in there was an emergency button that he pushed, which summoned the Tantan Makut, which flooded the town and froze it in place. And so that was, you know, the attempted coup was actually Papa Doc just being locked in the bathroom. But it was a wonderful trip. Haiti was then a very interesting place. Now it's even grislier than it was in Graham's day. Is that it? I can't talk anymore?
You can talk a lot.
If there's no more.
Has anybody got another question for Michael?
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're absolutely thrilled, Michael, that you could be here with us today and introduce your beautiful book. And we wish you every success with it, and we look forward to the new novel.